coming up on Tech Nation, in-home security with no gadgets to put on your windows, no need to arm it when you leave. I speak with Dr. Taj Manku, the co-founder of Cognitive Systems in Waterloo, Canada. Then a new segment on Tech Nation, Tech Nation Health, where we reimagine the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. Dr. Patricia Flatley Brennan, the director of the National Library of Medicine, joins us, along with chief correspondent for Tech Nation Health, Dr. Daniel Kraft. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Whenever we have institutions which have been around for a while, we tend to forget that they may not be permanent. The same goes for jobs. For centuries, there were people who drove horses. Whether just one or a team of horses, they drove everything from carriages and taxis to trucks laden with vegetables and every other supply to market. The rise and fall of such an activity can be traced through history, and frequently, the changes reflect changes in technology. And part of that history is that people have a tendency to hang on to anything which is familiar. Part of the reason it's difficult to let go of long-time fixtures is that people weren't around when they were created. And while technology can be blamed as the killer at any one point in time, we often forget that technology created the endeavor in the first place. Let's think about milk. Families use milk, and for years, there were milkmen. Everyone had a milkman, who in turn had a milk delivery route, which belonged to a particular dairy. That's quite a leap from the latest in refrigerators, which keep track of your milk and tell us that they can directly link into an online service, which will send more milk over to your home. You don't even have to be there, much less be part of the transaction. Come to think of it, this is not unlike having your own milkman. He came every day. You might leave him a note if you wanted something different or extra or less, or that you were going on vacation. It was a time when no one worried that the world would know you were out of town and someone might break into your house. And yet it was no job for weaklings. For starters, the milkman came by very early in the morning, perhaps 5 a.m. I remember waking up as a kid after a snowy, snowy night, and my mother opened the back door only to find that day's milk had frozen. The thick glass jug in those days only had a small waxy paper top, and it shot up several inches above the rim, having expanded upward as it froze. Any day that the milkman didn't show up would be remembered. In my life, I only remember one, and that day the snow was so deep the whole town shut down. Your milk bill didn't automatically get charged to your credit card or even get mailed to you. The milkman himself would knock on your door every so often and collect your bill in cash. That was much later in the day than when you laid in bed and heard that familiar clink of bottles in his wire basket as he delivered your daily milk. My grandmother remembered when milk was delivered by horse-drawn carriages. And no one had a refrigerator, which meant you also had an iceman for that block of ice in your icebox. Just as the nuance of this arc of milk delivery changes in the face of technology, no one today would argue that our society needs milkmen. So why, when it takes a second and a half for a tweet to go around the world and information is available anytime and anywhere, are we journalists arguing that society needs journalists? The easy answer is that truth is not milk. You don't consume it and need more tomorrow. Truth must stand the test of time. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, in-home security with no gadgets on the windows or need to arm the system when you leave. I speak with Dr. Taj Munku, the co-founder of Cognitive Systems in Waterloo, Canada. And a new segment from Tech Nation, Tech Nation Health, where we reimagine the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. Dr. Taj Munku is the co-founder of Cognitive Systems in Waterloo, Canada. Well, Taj, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, tell us, what is Aura?
So Aura is our first consumer product that Cognitive has produced. And Cognitive is about looking at wireless in a very different way. So we have other products, but Aura is what we're talking about with regards to providing security to people in their house. So think of a house. A house is sort of like a container, and then you have all these wireless signals jumping around. Obviously, they give you information to your phone, but they also do more than that. So when a person sort of walks in a house, you actually disrupt these signals, and you can tell, hey, somebody's come in, and it's very, very reliable. Also, because you're using wireless signals, you can also see, you know, for example, you know, a person walking into your house with a phone, you can say, hey, it's John came into your house. And when you take these two things and fuse it together, so you have the motion and then you have the ability to identify people with their phones, because everybody has a phone nowadays, then you're able to look at things like, hey, my son has came home at this time. There's lots of motion. Oh, geez, why is there so much motion at 2 a.m.? He shouldn't be playing his game or something like that. So you not only get the security aspect of it, it also gives you a little bit of insight into home awareness. So a classic example I always give people is I'm not home right now, obviously, but I have three cats. And I have a cat lady who comes in who takes care of the cat. And I can actually see very clearly that, hey, she came in at 9:30 and she left at 10. And because she's a member on my system, it automatically disarms for her. She comes in, she does whatever she needs to do. I see that motion and then she leaves. And that's sort of all contained within my house because my wireless signals are all contained within the house itself.
That sounds great. Now let's get to the technology. Let's just take the phones out of it for one thing, and then we'll bring the phones back in. Now, in my house, we have wireless all over the place.
Right.
And I have a wireless at one point, and at the other end, I have a repeater or an extender so that we have good signal everywhere. Is it the same kind of wireless that we have? Or is it different wireless?
It's pretty much the same. You know, wireless is it's a form of light, but it's just stuff our eyes just physically can't see, right? So as you move around in it, and if you could see that form of light, you would see not exactly what you see with visible light because it's different properties, but you would see distortions. You would see things sort of changing in that area where people are moving. And that's essentially – it doesn't matter whether – it's one type of wireless signal or it's another. I mean, they have slightly different properties, but generally speaking, you'll see some disruption in the wireless around, and that's sort of what we capture.
And so instead of on my standard wireless, which is sending data to my computer and my computer sending data back up or whatever device I have, it's sending out a signal, if you will, but it's also reading the signal that comes back in. And that's when it knows that something is moving inside
yes,
your house.
Yeah. So all your devices are communicating with each other, as you said. And as they're communicating, they actually sort of light up your house. And then as you walk through them, you distort them. But they're still communicating, but that communication is just a form of light. And then you end up distorting it, and then you sense that, well, there's presence of something moving because of this distortion, right?
So Your three cats, they don't carry iPhones around, do they?
No. Not yet.
Not yet. Can you tell they're moving around?
We have ways to combat that. So we have one of the ways is sensitivity. So our system, if we keep the sensitivity very high, super high, we can actually even sense people breathing. But the problem with that is that it's so sensitive that everything will be you'll see everything. So what we usually do is we turn down the sensitivity for this application for the home. So, for example, the cats, you won't really notice them for a couple of reasons. One is they're small. And secondly, they have a certain movement that is not human-like. And you can actually tell the difference between human movement and a cat movement. They obviously walk differently. They walk and stop sort of abruptly, sort of cats. So you can sort of build intelligence to this. So we sort of approach it from two ways. One is the sensitivity one, and the other one is just the general pattern that it produces.
That's a cat. That ain't no human.
Yes, exactly.
How about dogs?
So dogs, they also have a certain pattern when they walk. They're more hoppity. So when you look at the signals that they produce, they're a little bit different, and they're categorized by the way we sort of do our math. And they're categorized as being, this is a dog. Other movements such as fans or a mechanical movement, curtains, they also have a very, very unique signature that we can take out. And that's one of our advantages is we can look at these things and we can sort of extract them out and say, hey, this is not this. And that sort of helps us with false detections.
Okay. Now we're talking about somebody breaks into my home and they're not carrying a phone this particular time. We'll get to that phone business later. Can you tell that it's a human in my house?
Yes. So the way the system works is you arm it when you typically leave. So when they come in, they'll open the door, and that is a massive disruption in the signals. So that's the first thing that will probably – or they break a window or they somehow get in sort of an obtrusive way. You'll notice that, and then they will start walking around, and a human essentially is a big standing bag of water, as you can sort of imagine. This is what –
That's true. We're a lot of water.
We're a lot of water. And that's how we would sort of see, hey, that is a standing bag of water moving around in your house. And they're not supposed to be there. There's a big disruption that just happened. And now there's this organic material moving in your house that has this sort of structure like a human.
This is such a different concept than the idea of putting things on every window, every door to see if a door opened, to see if something broke. It's just talking about what is the space inside my home.
Exactly.
And what's happening there.
Exactly. So this is our concept of also brings about what we sort of label it as thoughtful security, is because it's really about your home. And it's also, from a privacy point of view, it's not a camera. You only need our system to secure your whole house because it's like a container. And, you know, most people don't want to have a camera in their bedroom. But this system, because it's non-intrusive, it actually is fine.
Now let's get to the phones. A lot of people don't realize that if they have an iPhone, an Android phone, any smartphone, that it's actually sending out a signal, and it will respond to any phones in the area. That's how it can pick up. This is how many wireless things are around. And so you can get a signature and an ID off a phone just by walking by.
Yeah. So for the home, we're very conscientious about the privacy issues associated with that. So the way we address it is people have to sort of accept. So when we say that you're a member, they have to accept, well, you know, we're going to be doing this. Because generally speaking, people don't like that. Okay, it is a privacy issue for a lot. So we address it by first allowing the person to say yes. Everything that is captured internally in our unit, depending on the application, but we usually encrypt everything before it leaves the physical unit. So we were very, very concerned about the privacy aspect, but we're trying to provide the benefit that, yes, you know, when a phone walks in, yes, it does admit it. It has a signature, and that signature is associated with that phone, and we can identify that phone. We do have other businesses where we provide to retailers, we provide them our unit, and they sort of can see, for example, you know, a person has a phone, that phone is in the toy section, and then we associate that phone to, let's call it person A, and then we realize, hey, person A is now in the clothing section. And that sort of helps the retailers use that information to sort of structure their marketing. But in that particular case, even then, we don't necessarily take the information from the phone. We just label it as an individual, and we call it person A. And then as they move around, we just call it person A, because it's always consistently the same person.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Taj Mankhu, the co-founder of Cognitive Systems in Waterloo, Canada. Their system, Aura, which is spelled A-U-R-A, Aura, provides security inside homes using everyday wireless signals to detect unexpected motion from unidentified sources. Now, you have a burglar breaks into your house, happens to have a great phone in his pocket.
Right.
Do you tell the police? This is the phone number?
You know, that is a big question. And it actually is more of a privacy issue. So right now, we don't do that.
There probably even aren't laws covering it.
In some states, there are. In California, there are. I know a lot of that one. Some states, there isn't. But it is slowly becoming an issue for various people. But for some military or some other applications like that, where they have the ability to do that because of their law, because of law enforcement, then they can do that without any of these privacy issues, right? So we do have partnerships and conversations with those types of folks as well, but for different market altogether.
And so the owners of this home, or they will also have an app on their smartphone. What does that tell them?
So the app tells them a couple things. It tells them, for their activity during the day. So, for example, you know, Johnny comes home, Johnny leaves at a certain time. You can detect the motion. So one of the things I joke with my son is sometimes I can tell when he's going to sleep. So, you know, I'd say we should go to sleep at 12. And he says, well, okay, I'll go to sleep at 12. And I can sort of see on my phone, because the way we plot the data, we can say, oh, geez, he went to sleep at 2. and now you can confront him and say, hey, you went to sleep at 2. And he's a very good kid. He'll say, yes, I did. So it provides you information about the motion in your house, provides you what's coming in, what's leaving. And with that information, you can then arm and disarm your system without you yourself doing it. It just sort of, and everybody's gone, it arms. When some member comes in, like, for example, in my case, the cat lady, she comes in and she might be a member, and it'll disarm the system. She'll do her stuff and she'll leave, and then it'll arm again.
So it's automatic. You don't, the whole business of going in and out of your house, of turning it on, turning it off, you don't have to do. If nobody's there, it's armed.
That's right.
If some member that's a trustworthy member, because you've signed them up, they brought their phone in and they signed up when they were there, then they're supposed to be there.
Yes.
So that's a pretty interesting aspect in and of itself.
Yeah. We're quite excited about that feature.
How prevalent is this approach? This seems new to me.
It is relatively new. In order for us to create this, so there's a history of the company a little bit here. So we had to, first of all, we created a prototype. But when you create a prototype, this thing can cost up to $10,000, $20,000. And to bring it down to the level where a consumer can afford it and where you can sort of do other things like create a network from it, you have to bring the price point down. So we had to come up with some very innovative ways to do that. And one of the things we did was we created our own chipset. So we created our own piece of silicon in order to enable us to effectively use wireless signals beyond just communication. And then on top of that, then these other things become applications. So for example, Detecting devices is an application that's on our platform. Detecting motion is an application that we provide. And all these applications then go into certain markets. So, but the basis of the company is around this chip that is relatively inexpensive. And from that chip enables to do what we're doing now. People have obviously done similar things before, but at a very, very artificial level, because they can't manipulate the signals like we can, because we can manipulate them and the radio can manipulate things within in the order of very, very small timing steps. And in order to do that, the whole system has to be very, very integrated. And if you integrate it on silicon, you get all these benefits. And on the chip, we also have a lot of processing power. So if we want to do, like, we can do LTE demodulation, which is very complicated.
And what are LTE?
So LTE is one of the most complicated cellular-based systems. It's like what they call 4G, I guess sometimes
yes.
they call it.
Yes, we'd recognize that.
Yes, so 4G, we can take those signals, which are very, very complicated signals. There's a lot of math required to take them and actually extract information from them. But our processor was designed to be able to do that as well. So it has a lot of applications, and all the applications then move into certain markets. And Aura is just an example of that chip going into the consumer market for security.
We always like to say no intellectual property, no company.
Yes.
So you're located in Canada. What is your intellectual property? Where have you protected it?
So we've obviously protected in a lot of places. We obviously file within – just because of the way the filings go, we usually file in Canada and U.S. first, and we do a European filing as well. And then we start doing other filings after what they call national phase comes up. We do filings in Japan, Korea, is it various other places. I can't remember all their names. But generally, we do a very, very broad coverage. So we've already been awarded a fair bit of patents already, because we have been working in this for about 2.5 years. And one of the things that was right from day one was to patent everything that we did, because we realized that people using wireless signals beyond communication is sort of a new thing. So we wanted to make sure that we can capture that market and make sure we can sustain that market going forward. And one of the things that we did from a business development point of view is spend a lot of time on protecting and being awarded these very, very fundamental patents.
We're talking about the software, the firmware within the chipset?
There's a couple of things. We have different levels of patents. One is we have what we call essential. Like, you cannot do motion with wireless without using this patent. It would be practically impossible. And then we have implementation patents, which then get into the nitty-gritty. Like, for example, we need to do something to the radio because the timing has to be right and this is the only way you can do it, and then we'll patent that one. And then we have defensive patents because we are producing a chip and we have some IP in our chip, the way we do things. We'll patent that stuff as well from a defensive point of view. Say, hey, well, we do have some intellectual property on the chip side, but we also have some on our system side, and then we have some on our implementation side.
You reminded me when you said defensive about the Department of Defense in the United States, military applications. I would guess that the military would be very interested in this.
Yeah, they are. So we do have engagements with the defense, in I guess the Secret Service departments, where they would use this device for a number of things. Some is very defense oriented, and some is more on the cybersecurity basis. So they basically use our stuff for those two areas. So there is a business in that sector as well.
I'll tell you, Taj, people are going to be following you around. It's like, what's he doing next? What is that guy doing? What's he thinking of next? One point I want to make is that if this were easy, if Aura was something easy to do, and the whole line of products that will be coming out in all many different ways here, but Aura, of course, the consumer-grade product – if it was easy to do, it would have been done, number one.
Yes.
And so even though you had the idea, nobody was really doing it, you had to keep working on the algorithms. You had to keep making it smarter, figuring out no, we saw the bag of water, but we completely missed the dog or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
We missed the window breaking or what's the profile of this and that? I mean, there is a lot of work that had to continually be done, right?
Yes. I mean, it's easy. So I could tell you a bit of a story. So when we started, we saw, okay, well, we're seeing motion. And that was probably a year ago, even longer than a year ago. So we were seeing it. We were saying, hey, our chip is seeing the motion and we can do it. And then taking that and making it reliable and making it so that you can tell the difference between a fan. Because sometimes even, for example, strong signals in your house that are interference, they can even look like motion. So you have to be able to filter those ones out. You have to be able to control the system within certain timing levels to be able to see these signals. As they say, the devil's in the details, right? Yes, conceptually it's easy to understand, but when you start getting into all these small little cases, the amount of effort to clear and to get those things all polished, this takes a long time. So this product, Aura, has been in development for a while. The company's been around for 2.5 years approximately. The motion stuff has probably been going on for about a year and a half. But to get to that perfection, you needed a team fully dedicated to looking at every little issue and setting up a lab that is repeatable and setting up an infrastructure that you can regress off, meaning that you can continuously test your system with different waveforms on a continuous basis 24 hours a day. Because anytime anybody does a software change, they've got to then make sure that it runs through the system and it still passes all the basic tests. And you have to do this very quickly because I can't have a room with a person running around. And every time we change something, that person is going to go in there, bring a dog, a fan, and we can't do it. So we had to figure out ways where we can test it within seconds, not days. So every time there's a change, it gets tested. So there's all these little details that have to be taken care of.
Dr. Taj Manku is the co-founder of Cognitive Systems in Waterloo, Canada. More information about Aura is available on the web at aurahome.com. That's A-U-R-A, Aura, aurahome.com. You're listening to Tech Nation. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, our new segment, Tech Nation Health, where we reimagine the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. Stay with us. Thank you. Welcome to TechNation Health, a new segment of TechNation, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. On today's TechNation Health, Dr. Patricia Flatley Brennan, the director of the National Library of Medicine, and our new regular chief correspondent for TechNation Health, Dr. Daniel Kraft. He's the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine and chair for medicine at Singularity University. Dr. Patricia Flatley Brennan is the director of the National Library of Medicine, located just outside Washington, D.C. at NIH, the National Institutes for Health, in Bethesda, Maryland. Well, Dr. Brennan, welcome to TechNation Health.
It's great to be here. Very exciting.
Now, you are the director of the National Library of Medicine. I hesitate to say that many Americans don't know we have a National Library of Medicine.
We have the largest collection of biomedical knowledge in the world, housed here in Bethesda, but not only here, because many of our holdings are now electronics. So the National Library of Medicine began as a bookshelf, and as the technologies have changed, it grew in two important ways. One was to acquire, to purposefully collect important knowledge of the world, and the second was to index it, to make sure it was accessible to other people. So now here at the National Library of Medicine, we have over 1,700 men and women involved in collecting and indexing and making available all sorts of information to people, from published articles that researchers write to genome sequences that are generated out of research experiments. We also happen to house a very important historical collection. Our History of Medicine division has very precious manuscripts, from Islamic medical manuscripts from the 11th century to Chinese texts that have helped us rediscover some important treatments for common illnesses. We also hold very important research reports from the 50s and the 60s, where the discoveries of the genome were coming about. And interestingly enough, they're our most fragile, because they are the technology to preserve information that's written with a ballpoint pen on not acid-free paper is not here yet. So our older manuscripts, 1800s, 1600s, they're doing pretty well, but they were printed on vellum. Our current ones, not so much. So we're working with chemical engineers to preserve them. So we have a range of researchers here, from chemical engineers to library scientists to computer scientists. We have the National Center for Biotechnology Information, which houses all the genome data and allows reference sequences to determine, for example, if the E. coli found in lettuce in California is the same E. coli, same strain that was found in Florida. We can trace drugs and the formal names of medications over a 20-year history of a patient, so we can look at their outcomes related to the kind of medications they were getting. So we do amazing things here. And we also have some books.
That's good. A book here or there.
Yep.
That's good. This is good. I have to say that most people know you through PubMed.
Yes.
And we just walked by the server farm.
Yes.
Which has, it's like there's a there to PubMed.
It really is there. PubMed is an electronic literature database that allows individuals to find articles that are relevant to terms and ideas that they're looking for. It currently indexes over 26 million articles. Every day we get more articles to be indexed. We have a small and important set of human indexers who read each article and tag words on it to make it easier to find. But we also use electronic methods. We work very closely with Google to make sure our search engines are optimized. And we've developed additional products on it. Some of our products link a paper in PubMed to, for example, the gene that's described underneath that paper, or to a data set that supports the results found in there. Others of our products, though, take one article and allow you to find related articles that might be available in your local library. So we try to help people find what they need and get what they want.
We were talking earlier, and I was very taken by the description that we were learning from experiments, and now we're learning from data. How is that different today?
The world is full of data that might come from your cell phones, might come from a genomic study of you, might look at how you're walking, not based on how often your foot falls, but how the muscles in your hip and the joints in your knee and the tendons in your ankle all work together. Thousands of different data points. In the past, we were constrained. We were only able to look at small elements of data, and then to make an interpretation required a statistical modeling technique. Now, We can take huge pieces of data, use visualization tools or machine learning, and really discover the intricacies so we know if your footfall is regular or irregular, exactly which part of your leg or your hip or your knee muscles aren't working properly.
Now, we know that you can get this data from all over the world. People can access this data from all over the world entirely free. We give it away.
We give it away.
As if it's worthless. No, it's highly valuable. Highly valuable. But you can also visit the National Library of Medicine.
We have a beautiful physical plant here that was built in the late 50s and early 60s. Some of you may have noticed a little bit of the Cold War feel to our building. We have 17-inch thick walls. We have very small windows. But our rotunda is a place where we're able to have exhibits, where we take some of our historical collection and show them to tours or to individuals who come in. We also have a reading room, like libraries around the world have had. And we also have librarians in that reading room to help you with a question. So any person can come onto our campus and get assistance getting a health-related question answered. So we aren't a lending library like many libraries are in communities, but we are a library resource that is open to citizens everywhere and actually to people all over the world.
And librarians that I know, they just want to make sure you get the right information at the right time.
One of the greatest skills that librarians bring is the conversation about information. So you may think, I've got a headache, or a researcher might think, I need to know about amitriptyline. But the librarian is the one who helps refine that into, what do you mean you have a headache? Are you worried about the symptom? Do you want to find a way to treat it? Are you worried that you have cancer? Or might say to the researcher, are you interested in the chemical compounds underlying that, or the consequences to the body, or the way it appears in electronic records? So librarians, if you will, act like a focus on information needs.
In fact, this is not just big data. This is like the biggest data of them all.
It's great. It's what's exciting here also is that librarians and library science is known for many, many years about the importance of cataloging, of indexing, of purposeful collections. And that knowledge now has a whole new market to address that is in the area of data. We have the capability of capturing way more data than we can possibly meaningfully process. So deciding what to save and what to let go of, what to preserve, what are our high-value data sets is a very complicated process. But the library science community, and now increasingly the computer science community, has begun to develop probabilistic methods to envision the future value of a piece of information collected right now.
That business of it's data until it's information, and that means it's in context, it's needed, and we know the context. So the value of much of the data here, we're not even sure of yet.
We have to make lots of educated guesses, and sometimes it's because our scientists explain how this fits into a process. But sometimes unexpected things happen when we reanalyze a data set. Years ago, it was thought, for example, that only the DNA transmission went from the mother to the baby in one-way direction, and that was it. Recently, we've learned that you can detect the DNA of the baby back in the mother. But it's been through, in part, extensive analysis of the genomic a display of a mother's blood data that we're able to determine this. And it's not transmitted in quite the same way, but it's given us new ways to think about how to test for fetal anomalies, for example. So what started out as a curious data problem has ended up changing a whole area of practice.
In fact, we're talking also about supporting people every day. You get requests from whether it's an emergency situation in which a doctor or a team of doctors need information they can't find, to an everyday doctor saying, I've got to find out about this, and there's no time to do that.
And we also get requests from moms and kids and dads and family members wanting to understand something about their person. And one of the things that's important in our system is that we're open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So let me tell you a little bit about the ways people come in to access our information. We have a special disaster information resource unit in our specialized information services, and they provide quick information in the times of disaster, like when Hurricane Matthew was coming into the coast. They quickly put up a website that would provide local information, how to get shelter, where to get resources, but also information about how to manage your diabetes when you're away from your refrigerator. So the idea of presenting information at the moment that people need it requires us thinking about what that moment looks like. Sometimes people come to our website and simply type a question, and we have to figure out what it is they're trying to ask. And what we've learned is that lay people ask questions in a language very different than scientists use it. We also provide information access to over 250,000 clinical trials. So if a patient is looking for a clinical trial or a physician wants to refer a person, they can simply come to our website, put in a query, and they'll be returned the clinical trials that are open, available, and accruing. Now, you talked about people who need information in the moment, and we've become an in-the-moment society. Much of our information is delivered back to people through mobile devices. Much less often now do people sit down at a computer, type in, and see a set of results. So we're learning ways to present short summaries of articles to people so they can be read and understood quickly. We also have a large document delivery service so that if an individual needs information in the moment and they need the full article, we're able to get it for them if we have the access to. But we're not just an electronic library. We're not just this building on the campus of NIH. We have a national network of libraries of medicine that has over 6,500 members, hospital libraries, public libraries, academic health centers, and they provide a network and a reach into every single community. So sometimes someone might send us a query and we can direct them back to an office next door or down the street to get more assistance of a professional librarian.
Now, you're new to these parts.
Yes, I am.
You only came, was it 6 months ago?
Not quite. August the 15th, I came on to. Now, I have a little bit of history. I spent a year here 15 years ago. So I do know a little bit about how to get the metro into the campus, and I do know a little bit about the building. But I joined the library in August of 2016 as the fourth appointed director. I am the second woman to lead the library because in the interim between Dr. Lindbergh, who was our previous director for over 30 years, and my arrival, Betsy Humphrey served as the interim director for about 18 months. So although I'm the first nurse, I'm the second woman to lead this.
Which also tells us you're actually not a library scientist. You're a nurse. You have a PhD in industrial engineering.
So it shows, huh? The library part was all a fake.
That's right.
Not really. I have been studying information, particularly the way we can use technology to bring information into people's lives for self-management for more than 30 years, actually. And when I was first approached about becoming the director of the National Library of Medicine, I was very excited because I'm a researcher, and in my past, the library's extramural research program has funded my research, has allowed me to do some testing of developing home care computer networks and seeing how they help people. But when I started to interview, I said, you guys know I'm not a librarian. And so a lot of the things that are familiar to librarians, I had to learn very quickly. I am trained in a field called medical informatics. Medical informatics is a specialized focus of computation, decision science, information science, and clinical practice. So bringing that all together, I have some familiarity with particularly how we need information to drive practice. But the first couple weeks I came here, I have to say I went to a lot of classes so that I would be able to both understand the complexity of our enterprise here as well as use the words right. Because I know now that indexing and cataloging are two different things.
You know a lot more now than when you started. When I look at some of what you've shared with the public, you know, since you've become the director, some of these have been called audacious goals. I think that's your term. What are your audacious goals?
As the director of the National Library of Medicine, it's my hope that in 10 years, our research program, our patron services and our resources ensure that every single clinical decision, whether made by a patient or a doctor or a nurse, is the best informed, best decision for that individual person. So that requires us to take advantage of the Precision Medicine Initiative that's happening on campus that's going to recruit 1 million people around the country and understand their biological and behavioral basis. It requires that we have very advanced imaging and computer tools that we can reach into people's lives and help them with making decisions. And frankly, it requires that we have very sophisticated information synthesis. There's too many articles to read. You can't expect a busy clinician or a harried mom to look through pages and pages of articles. So we need natural language processing and other kinds of machine learning to present information in accessible, actionable units. So my audacious goal is the library becomes a partner in health for everyone.
You've already suggested that when they approached you, you were like, you've got to be kidding. You weren't looking online for this job.
No,
that was not the case. And yet you've got a very full career that kept expanding into new areas and new topics. I think that we need now a different vision of how to lead our careers, because we just can't envision what's going to happen 10, 20, 30 years from now where we could be very effective. What would you say to people who are just starting or mid-career about how to approach that?
I believe that you're referring a little bit to the fact that in the last 5 years of my career, I worked in virtual reality, which is not something that I ever had ever envisioned. The beginning of my career, I was going to help nurses make better decisions with patients. So over a 30-year career, I went from thinking about decision-making in the moment in a clinical practice to virtual worlds that helped people envision new lives. In retrospect, my career looks very organized to me. I always wanted to help people make better decisions. I just used different tools to do that. But in fact, it wasn't quite so organized, and it was very much peppered with luck and good colleagues and great mentorship. So the first thing that I would say to people launching on a career is to try to keep a focus on what is the essence of your career. And it's rarely your job. It's the thing that your job enables you to do. It enables you to communicate to the public. It enables you to build an infrastructure or to create a product line. Any specific job should feed what it is you want to do. Second, you must always be open to the unexpected opportunity. And every time you find yourself saying, no, that's really not what I want to be doing, it's important to give yourself one more pause. Why am I saying no to this? Because that will tell you, maybe it's the right thing to say no to, but maybe there's something that you want to do that you don't see in that opportunity. I had planned to retire when I was approached for this position. And when I got the call, I said, oh, I'm retiring. I'm not interested in a big job in Washington. And I was going to retire and commit myself and my life to social justice, to secure housing for people in need. And as I talked to the people on the search committee and I talked about my vision of that and how it was related to simulating industry and bringing information into the point of decision making, they said, oh, doesn't that sound like the job we want you to take? And so sometimes finding your mission in what's in front of you is really helpful.
Say yes for a while.
Yeah, say yes for a while. And I had two more little pieces of advice. One of them is you have to be ready for mid-career corrections. You have to be ready to say, oh, made the wrong decision, got to turn this way. And the one thing you're not going to realize is the middle happens a lot. And so you just have to say, time to take a left turn, time to go straight, time to move along. And that requires you to have really good friends and colleagues and great mentors, because they're the one that help you make that step, getting off a track that isn't useful for you. And the second thing I would say is mentorship is really important. Mentorship is really critical. And no one gives you a mentor for Christmas. And you don't walk down the street and have someone stop you and say, I'd like to be your mentor. Your mentorship is something that the mentee initiates. And you can reach out to the best person you know, or the best person you know of, even if you don't know them, and invite them into your life and invite them into your journeys. Mentors interact in all different ways. I am blessed to have three very good mentors who I've known, one for 20 years, one for 30 years, and one for five. And the one that I've known for 20 years, I see almost every month or speak to. The one I've known for 5 years, I've actually only seen three times, but she's been a profound influence in my life. Pick your mentors well. It really helps.
Dr. Patricia Flatley-Brennan is the director of the National Library of Medicine, located outside Washington, D.C. at NIH, the National Institutes for Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And now our regular chief correspondent for TechNation Health, Dr. Daniel Kraft. He's the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine and chair for medicine at Singularity University. Daniel, what do you have for us today?
I thought today we'd talk about the world of 3D printing and how that impacts health and medicine. It's a huge technology. It crosses so many spectrums in health and medicine, and it's this idea of personalizing and bringing technology to match the individual. So I thought that'd be an interesting topic that crosses a whole spectrum.
Now tell people about what is 3D printing. Not everybody gets it.
Well, it describes a broad range of technologies, often also called digital manufacturing. The idea that you can take something and design it on a computer in three dimensions, whether it's a key, a little toy, all the way, as we'll talk about, to medical devices, design them and literally print them on a printer in three dimensions. So you can literally take your imagination and print. Usually it's been in a single type of plastic or now into metal. But now we're starting to blend different types of materials together. So it's a really powerful technology, and it's disruptive to the point where, you know, China might not be shipping little widgets across the ocean. You might be printing them at home. And just like we now have often have inkjet printers in our home, we used to go to the Kinko's or wherever to make them. It's getting so much faster, cheaper, and better. 3D printing is revolutionizing and impacting many fields.
And you're able to do this in 3D in so many different materials.
Correct. I mean, the early ones are sort of plastic, but now we can do metal. We can start 3D printing in electronics into these devices. We're even 3D printing early stages of printing homes and large structures. So all the way down from the very minute level that could be used in health and medicine, inside our bodies even, all the way to large structures. And so it's a really interesting area, and it creates opportunities across education for kids to design and print, to print an organ, for example, that might be diseased that you can actually get operate on, all the way to little widgets you might print in your home to use for fun and education.
Give us a couple of examples of what we're seeing at least soon, if not here already.
Well, there's some examples already in health and medicine that you may not appreciate, but are all around us. So hearing aids today are almost standardly made with 3D printing. You can scan now the sort of outer ear of an individual, and now a lot of these hearing aids are made to actually custom fit the inside of that ear. And as hearing aids get smaller and smarter, you know, they're going to be embedded with artificial intelligence and things like Siri and AI that will guide the individual. Those are 3D printed. We're seeing technologies for braces. Companies like Invisalign will scan your misaligned teeth with the help of the orthodontist and send a set of 3D printed molds that help re-blend and often replacing standard braces. So those are examples of 3D printing already well into production. And we think sort of touching health and medicine, let's take a common element, a fractured bone, and you wear a cast on your arm that's often heavy in plaster. And, well, what we're starting to see early versions of is you can scan that fractured arm and potentially even in the emergency room or in the orthopedic clinic print a cast or a brace that will fit the individual arm or hand that's going to match your anatomy, might expand and grow with swelling in smart ways, and are going to be wearable on the beach or in the shower, unlike our standard plastic casts. So that's an example of that could hit orthopedics. If you go inside the body with orthopedics, we're seeing companies start to 3D print personalized hip and knee implants. An area where a certain set of patients might have difficulty using the off-the-shelf versions. So there's companies like Conformis, which are literally taking your MRI scan, printing your hip or your knee implant element, and even the instruments that go with that in the operating room. So we're going to see that being disruptive to the medical device world, to the point where as these printers get faster, we might even print things in the operating room to match your anatomy or the device that's needed on the fly. And to take one small example on the extreme, so I chair medicine at Singularity University. One of our early startups is called Made in Space. They thought about, what if you could 3D print objects on difficult to access places like the space station? So about 2 years ago, they flew the first 3D printer to the space station, and they can print relatively large objects up to maybe a foot in size, including something like medical instruments. Difficult place to get a medical supply mission too. So you might 3D print a scalpel holder or some other element you might need in an emergency situation or on a submarine or Antarctica. So this idea of being able to print on demand everything from a medical device, from a splint to an orthopedic type device is already here today. And as these technologies get faster, smarter, and easier to use, we're going to see them democratize healthcare around the planet, including for things like prosthetics. You know, the prosthetic world, let's say if you're missing for some reason from trauma, injury, or disease, a limb, the prosthetic devices pretty much look like they did since World War II. We're starting to see much more integrated prosthetics that blend with bionics and smart electronics and sensors. And now you can design that prosthetic to match the missing limb. And so there are companies that are doing that in very low-cost ways for the developing world. For example, countries that have had a lot of war and landmine issues with kids and adults who've lost limbs but don't have access to personalized prosthetics. Now we're seeing companies here in San Francisco, one called Unique, which will print outer layers of prosthetics to match your own personality. You have a tattoo on one leg, you want to have a tattoo on your prosthetic, it can be a cover. Or another element might be for, let's say, a lot of adolescent teenagers, women especially, have scoliosis. And the braces that they have to wear are kludgy and uncomfortable, and that technology is very much made by hand, hasn't changed in years. Now you can scan that individual and print a a scoliosis brace that might match not just the design and need of their back as it changes over time, but their personality. Add in their favorite Pokemon character or their name. So lots of ways to personalize things with 3D printing. Those are just a couple examples.
One of the things that hits me is that in all of this, you aren't talking about it's so vastly expensive or that you need all of this training. This is kind of a technology that kind of came of age right away.
Well, 3D printing it's been around for 30 plus years, but it's now in that exponential range where as it doubles in its capability and gets cheaper, you can buy a 3D printer for $100. You can make your own little finger cast if you sprained or fractured a finger at home. It doesn't take an engineering degree now to use the software and hit the print button. So it does democratize healthcare. It means we could literally 3D print a prosthetic limb in the developing world for $50 as opposed to thousands of dollars traditionally. So it does democratize both the application for healthcare and education. One interesting area around education is, you know, if you're a surgeon, you're going to go into let's say a rare brain malformation, and you're going to do operation there. There may not be any patients with that exact anatomy. Now you could print that blood vessel in the brain or strange abnormality and let the surgeon visualize it, hold it, see it, and now combine that even with things like virtual reality and augmented reality to practice those procedures. So we're seeing this convergence of things like 3D printing, augmented and virtual reality with medical education and personalization, including to the point where we're seeing the 3D printing move inside the body. So if you go from outer sort of wearables, like a brace I mentioned for orthopedic issues or a crutches that might match your hand or your armpit, we're seeing situations in rare patients where they may need surgery on their trachea after something like a cancer or tuberculosis. And in several published trials, folks have developed 3D printed trachea to replace one that's damage, seed that with the patient's own endothelial cells in the sort of the test tube, and implant those back in the individual patient. So the blending of 3D printing and biology is here in very sort of early ways. And then people want to take it to the next level. What if we could 3D print organs? You know, we have a big issue with a shortage of enough organs for heart, lung, kidney transplants. We're seeing now the replacement of ink the traditional way with stem and progenitor cells. So your cartridges could have different types of cells and can start to print those in patterns that will enable you to create blood vessels, as companies like Organova have done, or print, at this point, small organs like microlivers or kidneys that can be used for testing drugs in the test tube. And the hope is that we might start to create large organs that could literally be a 3D printed kidney, and not just from any cells, but from your own stem and progenitor cells. So there's a lot of interest and a little bit of hype in that area. But I think in the next decades, we'll see the ability to take a skin cell, turn them into your own pluripotent stem and progenitor cells, and literally make your own ink to develop these organs, mature them in the test tube, and then put them back in your own body.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine and chair for medicine at Singularity University. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.